from KFNX News Talk Radio 1100, it's Chatterbox, where you'll find the latest news, interviews, and updates about the gaming world. The views and opinions expressed are those of the host, the guests, and callers only, and not necessarily those of KFNX News Talk Radio 1100. And now here's your hosts for Chatterbox.
Welcome to another week of the Chatterbox Video Game Radio Show. My name is Alon.
And my name is the thoroughly overworked Ara.
That's Ara the S-bomb over there.
Yes, well, I've been experiencing a lot of S-bombs lately.
Yeah, and that's because you're working overtime to try and get your game done.
That's right.
Drive straight to the studio, right?
We're doing what's called crunching, which means that you work a lot and you don't do a lot of other things, so...
This is what happens at the end of the development life cycle of pretty much any game, or probably any piece of software.
And in some studios, it happens at the beginning and in the middle and in everywhere else, really. But we're pretty good.
In your case, I know that you haven't been working crazy hours until it really comes down to the crunch time at the end.
Yes.
When, is it mandatory overtime or just very encouraged?
Well, see, here's the thing. I mean, I don't know... You know, I like doing what I do, right? So I've never explored the boundaries of, okay, well, you know, what's going to happen if I don't actually stay long and, you know, do all the work that I'm supposed to do and all that other stuff. So I don't know, to answer it the short way.
Okay.
But probably, I mean, if you don't, they'll probably be like, yeah, you'll probably get fired eventually, I guess.
You're not doing as much as Johnson. Johnson's staying 50 hours. Well, then you work 55, and Johnson's not working as much as you, so he works 60 hours, and then you go... That's an interesting little juxtaposition you've got there.
Yeah, but the funny thing is about making games, which, you know, a lot of people don't seem to realize, is that you're never really done. I mean, you don't...
Well, they say that about all art.
Yeah, yeah, but in games it's even worse, because, like, okay, like, if you're painting... You at least know that, like, your state of doneness is limited to, like, you know, your frame of, like, you know, 3x4 feet or whatever.
Yeah.
Right? You know, you're not going to start painting on, like, the walls. That's a different painting. So.
Well, I mean, you can approach the minutia of the painting, but at that point, you're sort of escaping what people might actually see.
Right.
In said painting.
Right. So there's, like, kind of, like, a limit to it, right? I mean, when you're making a game, it's kind of like, I don't know, it's kind of like in math when you, like, multiply infinity times infinity. And
yeah.
You get, like, different levels of infinities. Yeah, so you, like, not only are you never done, but you're almost just, like, never done being never done, if that makes any sense.
Okay. No, not at all. But I could see where you're going with it, and that's good.
I just really emphatically wanted to express how never done you really are.
Okay.
So there
and
you
so,
go.
Given that the project is infinite, the percent complete of this project is approaching zero, correct?
Well, see, that's the thing. It's like, you know, at some point you just have to stop working and you just have to say, okay, well, this is good enough, right? So that's why I always laugh when, you know, like video game magazines and stuff will just be like, oh, yeah, this game's like, you know, 20% complete. And
it's unfinished.
You know, this is 50% complete and this is 95%. You know what? All those people are just pulling numbers out of their asses. I mean, they just aren't. You're just making up numbers. I mean, you're just like, oh, this feels like 50%.
Well, in the development cycle, I mean, you have benchmarks. Your people lay out a plan and say, we're going to have this much done at this point and this much done at this point and this
right.
sort of
I mean,
implementation
the,
here
you
and
could,
there.
You could say that like, oh, okay, well, you know, we're 7/10 of the way to when we have to stop, so therefore we're 70% done. You could say that.
I guess that's one way to look at it. But though they normally look at it and like, they say, all right, we're going to consider it 25% done once the initial level design is complete. And then, you know, the next 15% is the graphical polish on the levels.
Right.
Meanwhile, we've got a group of people working on character design and physics implementation. And eventually you approach the end and the last so much percent is like testing and refining existing designs.
Theoretically, that's the process.
Okay. And they sort of decide like this much manpower is going to go into, you know, up to this benchmark. So I think that probably has something to do with how they determine percent completeness. Have you ever been involved in that sort of road mapping for the game design?
Not a lot, I have to say.
Because you have project managers who probably run all those little Visio programs and stuff.
We do, and you know I have to say that in my game development career, I have experienced varying levels of, how should I say, quality in planning. let's just say.
Micromanagement?
No. Don't read into my words any, because there's nothing to read into. But, you know, it's really hard to plan the game's life cycle. And without specifically mentioning anything, I have to say that, you know, there's so many unknowns, at least in my experience. I mean, maybe somebody out there who works on games or has been part of games has been in a project that was, like, really, really awesome and really expertly planned and all that stuff. I haven't.
Well, it's funny because there's all these, I mean, maybe our listeners aren't aware, but there are places you can go to read postmortems on game development. And Gamasutra is one of the, you know, premier places to go read about the design challenges faced by designers and producers and whatever. So that sometimes they'll focus, they'll interview one person and say, all right, what was your experience making this game? What went
right?
What went wrong?
And you know what? I have to go out on a limb and say, you know, I'm going to be the cranky guy who's complaining again and say that, you know, I think a lot of those postmortems, they're very politically correct, let's just say.
I've noticed that too. I have. But also, I think because they realize that the audience is limited, that not a lot of people are going to this stuff, you do tend to get more truthfulness out of a postmortem than you do out of, you know, your classic game pro interview or whatever.
Well, right. Well, those things, because most of those interviews are even farther removed from the reality of what, you know, the process is like. Because a lot of times, you know, those interviews are like, oh, well, we got to, you know, they're kind of, a lot of times they're filtered through PR, or they're done with producers who are basically giving it a PR angle anyway. And, I mean, really, I mean, it's not to say that, like, I don't know, it's wrong or whatever, but it's just like, you guys, I mean, people should, who read interviews and stuff, should really expect that everything just goes through this kind of, like, PR filter, because this is a part of the company's image that they're trying to project to, you know, everybody else out there. So, obviously, they're going to try and project the best image out there.
Yeah, I mean, oftentimes you'll even have the interviews being done by people who actually work in the marketing department.
Right,
and
right.
We, I mean, we've done
or
this
stuff
on,
like that.
Done that on this show. I've had marketing people on the show, too. And, you know, whether or not that turns into an interesting interview really has more to do with the interviewer, I think. But regarding postmortems, you find a lot of interesting stuff in there. Like, I think I've mentioned on this show before, but I read a postmortem for Big Mother Truckers.
Nice.
Remember, this game was on the PS2, and I think it was on, might have been on the Dreamcast. And anyway, like, I learned that that game was one of the very first games to implement content streaming from the disc on a PlayStation 2. Apparently, it was like, it was a very interesting concept at that point. And although the game, I don't think, did terribly well, perhaps because of the premise of the game.
Or all kinds of other things, maybe.
Or maybe it was implemented badly. I don't know. I never even played it. But
actually, neither did I.
You know, you learn things about the background and the development of these games that you never would have considered, and they also can tell you, like, this. The reason I brought it up was because we were talking about the development and the planning of a game, right? And you realize that there's all these people who have tons of experience. I mean, lots of games have been made, so lots of people have experience making games and seeing what has failed, and you would expect that at this point, right, what, 20 years, 25 years into game making, certainly the last 10 years have had a lot more in common than perhaps making a game 20 years ago when it was one guy in his garage. But now there's big teams and stuff. You'd expect that there's a large grouping of information regarding how to properly plan and organize for this sort of thing.
There is in theory. The problem is that the game development process is extremely laden with risk. There's all kinds of weird technology risks. So a lot of times what happens, you know, for example, a lot of designers, right, don't like doing a lot of documentation. But documentation is important. But the reason why a lot of designers, like, you know, myself, don't like too much documentation is because in our experience, you can document all this stuff that's awesome, right? And then when you get to the implementation part, you find out, wow, you know what? We have to go around so many of these technical roadblocks that what we end up with has so little to do with what we wrote in the first place. We just wasted our time writing it.
Heard that. And we have to go to break. So we will be back after this vote. Stay with us.
Oh.
Welcome back, everybody, to Chatterbox Video Game Radio. My name is Ara.
And I'm Alon.
And we also have our very special...
I'm still here.
What's his title?
Senior Investigative Reporter of Crap That People Don't Care About, something like that.
That's Rich. Good enough.
You're the one with the acronym on your shirt. I don't remember.
Yes.
So yeah, we did bring you in. There's a couple things that you're going to bring to our attention as the Senior Investigative Reporter of Crap That People Don't Care About. But there's a couple things I want to mention first. As always, I like to mention our wonderful sponsor, the University of Advancing Technology. That's uat.edu. You can go visit them and see what they're all about and how they can help you get into the games industry. Now, also, today, I was talking with Robert Koo from Penny Arcade, trying to get the plans together for the Penny Arcade Expo, because Chatterbox, for the last 2 years, has been part of the Penny Arcade Expo when we did the Chatterbox Treasure Box. I know that you two weren't involved at Chatterbox back then when we did it. Actually, you were part of it, but you just didn't go to Penny Arcade Expo last year. You were hosting at the time.
Yes, I did not go last year.
Can you believe you've been on the show for over a year now?
You know what?
About a year?
I was thinking of mentioning that. You know what? I wasn't sure how long I've been here, but you know, maybe I'm just going to like some kind of Lyndon LaRouche youth union member, just simply assert that I've been here a year and just assume it's true.
Very close to a year. If it hasn't happened yet, we're right at that cut.
In fact, this is my 1 year anniversary.
Sure. Definitely. We should have a party.
And, you know, I hate all those Satanists, and we should impeach everybody. Yeah.
I don't know what you're talking about, but okay.
Party.
Now, this weekend, we had a little party, myself and you two both attended.
Oh, yes.
We watched me on the 10MPH video.
Yes, that was very, very interesting.
Apparently, I'm naked in the movie almost.
No, what are you talking about?
Very close.
It's quite entertaining.
I forgot that they had filmed me while in my
boxers.
Oh,
yes, that part. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were naked in that part.
Nothing but the boxers.
You realize that like everybody thinks you're like talking about some crazy porno now or something?
No. So I've mentioned on the show many times, and for a whole year, I hosted the show while on the road. Well, not a whole year, excuse me, 3 or 4 months.
Let's just say it was a year.
Sure, a year. Whole year.
Exactly, to the day.
I hosted the show from the road because I was crossing the country with a group of people. One guy was on a Segway, and we made a documentary over the course of that three-month period or a year-long period, as the case may be. And it finally became available on, like, May 29th or something, the day after Memorial Day or Labor Day or whatever that day was recently. And so I finally got a copy of it myself and got to watch it. We had a big premiere at my house, and I just thought I'd mention it. If anybody wants to see it, you can go to 10mph.com and...
Everyone should buy it because these people apparently spent lots and lots of their own money. And
I'm sure they're making plenty of it at this point.
Okay, they're making plenty. Okay, you don't have to go buy it then.
But
don't
you can Netflix it. You can put it in your queue or your Blockbuster queue or whatever. You'll get to see a little bit of what I did on that trip. And I know that at least maybe one or two of our listeners are interested in that sort of thing because we might still have a listener or two from 3 years ago.
Speaking of listeners or two, I just want to mention that if you guys want to call us and, you know, have some kind of like, you know, on-air fight or something, you can call us at 866-536-1100. We love getting calls.
What he means to suggest is that we could discuss the qualities of a postmortem with our listeners.
Or anything you'd like to talk about. Maybe you accidentally, you know, like threw a Wii controller at someone and killed them. I don't know.
Moving back to gaming, one thing I wanted to talk about was something I've consistently forgotten to discuss the last 2 or 3 weeks. I finally got a hold of the Red Star. I bought a copy of the Red Star, which is, as we've mentioned several times, a game that Ara was, you weren't lead designer, but you were like an important designer on.
I'd like to say that I was one of the core designers.
Okay, we'll say that. You're like number 4 listed in the credits, so.
Yeah, and I will never get tired of talking about it, so I'd be happy to talk about it for as long as you like.
All right, so it was the first game project you worked on that actually came to fruition, and it took forever to do so.
Right.
I finally got a hold of it. GameStop finally got a copy. They refused to get one on release, but they finally did. You were forced to buy many copies from Amazon and sell them to your friends because otherwise they wouldn't buy it because they didn't want to buy it online or something.
Yeah, and actually, like, I don't think they wanted to buy it, but, you know, I would just do the Gary Busey thing and finally
give him the disc
it.
And say, you owe me $20. Yeah. So I finally got a chance to play it. And I mean, I think I played it once at your house, some old version a long time ago. But
yeah, which was better than the one that actually came out, but I digress.
There's always a strange feeling. Like, for those who've demoed a game, and now it's a lot easier to demo a game, right? But back in the day when we go to E3 and you only get like 2 minutes to play a game, it's the incomplete game. You don't see the story. You don't really see the control mechanisms. You're rushed because someone's behind you. You don't really get the opportunity to put your whole self into this, the game that you're playing, whether you play for 5 minutes or 20 minutes. But now I finally had my own copy. I got to play the whole game. And, you know, I'm not just saying it because Ara's on the show. Like, I actually really enjoyed the game. It had an interesting combo system, which I didn't expect from a game that is part shooter. And I want to play it with Ara. I've never actually played a commercial release game with one of the developers of the game. And I think that would be a really fascinating experience.
It's kind of like an unending commentary track live.
Like listening to the director's commentary while watching a movie. Like when we were watching the movie that I was in this weekend, I kept talking about it beyond what was on the screen, and people seemed to find that somewhat interesting because I had all this extra input.
That was good.
Yes. Right? And it's always nice to hear, you know, like non-politically correct, like just, you know,
yeah,
complaining about personal things and like, oh, this guy like was, you know, farting too much in the office and all that other stuff.
All the truth. Yeah. So,
yes, the truth is better.
So I really want to sit and play the game with you and see, like, because sometimes they... Or at least the assumption is that the person who makes the game is an amazing master of said game, right? And I assume that given that you're just good at shooters, you're going to be good at this game.
Yeah.
I'd like to see, like, could you clear it blindfolded and with one life the whole way through? Like,
yeah, well, obviously, you know...
It's just, kind of a hard game.
Well, just so people know, right? Like, I worked on the shooter parts. There's another designer who primarily did the melee system. And so, you know, like, I'm not so good at the melee stuff. I'm really good at the shooter stuff, you know, because I made it. So, yeah, I actually thought that it didn't really get, it got pretty hard near the end. But, you know, the kinds of games that I drew inspiration from, some of the really, really hardcore shooters that most people don't know about, like, I don't know, like Esp Galuda, if anyone's heard about that, which you probably haven't.
I have.
Except for Alon and, no, Rich is.
Never.
No, I've heard it. Like, I've seen the name.
Okay. Like, no, game, a game like that. You know, I fashioned some bullet patterns that were reminiscent of that game, and they only kind of appear at, like, the very end of our game, right? And this is the kind of stuff that you would see, like, in the second stage of their game. So I thought that I was actually making it kind of easy. In retrospect, I think that I probably should have made, you know, the beginning parts of the game even easier. But it's kind of funny because, you know, when I read reviews and stuff about... you know, either in publications or people just giving their comments about the game, everyone's all over the place as far as, like, how hard or easy they think it is. Some people are like, oh, it's so hard, I can't get past this stage. Other guys, oh, they made this way too easy. It's kind of interesting how that goes.
See, I can appreciate the difficulty in it. And honestly, I didn't think the beginning of it was too hard, but, you know, I'm an experienced gamer. I think once I got to, I think it was chapter 7, I got through one part where I had to play over and over and over, and I had to use a really cheesy move which I couldn't have done had I not gotten a particular upgrade earlier. So if I hadn't gotten that upgrade, I would have totally failed. And
right.
The upgrades, like, you choose from a long list of upgrades. I happened to get the one that allows me to regenerate health if you kill somebody. And so I just let enemies appear on the screen, and easy enemies, so that I could kill them repeatedly,
yeah,
like 60 or 70 of them, so I could get enough energy to continue to the next portion of the level and not die. And that really pissed me off. And Ara's like, well, yeah, and the way you did that, by destroying these particular lasers, yeah, I originally designed those to be indestructible. Right? So it would have been just completely impossible for me to do had you not made
yes,
it that
yes.
much easier and
but
destructible.
Actually, the context was a little different, right? Because when I made them to be indestructible, they weren't going to be used in precisely that context. Although, yeah, you know what? When you're making something like that, like, sometimes it takes, you know, somebody else to, like, you know, look at it and be like, hey, dude, this is, like, way flipping too hard. You, like, you can't do this.
Yeah, so there's this, there, you have this small channel up the center of the screen, right? And there's all the stuff on the side. You can't go there because it's not ground that you can walk on.
Yeah.
So I want to walk through the center towards the end, and you have to shoot a door down, right? It takes a long time to shoot the door down because it's got a lot of strength or hit points or whatever, right? So there's these guys coming at you who are shooting bullets at you and trying to attack. Meanwhile, there's three lasers on each side of this walkway. Remember, the walkway is not very big. It's maybe a fourth the width of the screen, or a third. I don't know. I can't remember. And so there's a laser at the bottom of the screen, the middle of the screen, the top of the screen, on both the left and the right sides. And they're rotating, and they go almost infinitely across the screen, right? And so you get this big pattern that's moving while enemies are coming at you. There's no easy jump All you can do is do like a backflip. You can't specifically jump.
You didn't get what you had to do there. But
I did. I had to backflip over the laser.
No. I'll tell you afterwards.
I destroy the laser. Yes. But before I could destroy it, I had to backflip over it. Big pain. We'll be right back.
Hello, it's me, Mario. You're listening to Chatterbox Video Game Radio. It's number one. Woohoo!
Once again, Chatterbox Video Game Radio is back on the air.
Or maybe on your
time-shifting podcast mechanism, such as an iPod or any other MP3 player.
A Zune.
I was really tired because of crunching, but I took a bunch of Ritalin, so...
All right, so there was one more thing we wanted to cover about the Red Star before moving on, right? So you were saying that I was doing something wrong when I was... This grid of lasers was thrown at me, saying I had to jump over them, and the only jump is by backflipping.
Okay.
Do a
I don't want to say that you were doing something wrong, because this is kind of like the classical like game designer error, you know, to kind of like tell the player that you're not doing something the way you're supposed to.
Or that there was only one particular solution.
Well, no, there may be, but really, like, you know, the fact that you were doing that doesn't mean that it was wrong. You know, this whole... It's kind of hard to visualize this unless you actually played this part of the game, but the whole idea was, you know, I had this spinning turret, right? And it had four lasers coming out of it.
Yes.
Right? And it wasn't supposed to be something you'd blow up. It was basically supposed to be a obstacle where you could modulate the position of the lasers by shooting it at a certain rate of speed. So the whole idea of it that I was trying to communicate to the player was that, well, you have this turret, and these lasers are encroaching on you, but if you shoot it a couple times, right, they move back.
Do they?
Yes.
I had no idea.
It spins in the opposite direction when you start shooting it. And so you can modulate its position.
That sounds terribly complicated.
It's actually not complicated.
No, if I knew that.
It's actually very simple.
I was wondering how I defined its movement.
But the problem is that, you know, in this game, we didn't really... Like, it was a very unique type of enemy because it really wasn't an enemy. And so, you know, the problem... It was a communication issue. I couldn't really adequately...
Well, there's one at the very beginning of the game that teaches me that it's destructible.
Right. Well,
but it doesn't teach me that I can rotate its turret.
Well, I think what happens is that, you know, because people in the game will just shoot willy-nilly and they'll not notice that, you know, when it's not being shot, it's rotating in a certain direction. And when it is being shot, it's rotating in the opposite direction.
Now, I'm with you there, but on the same token, there are points in this game that are very unrealistic because you say, you put a big old splash graphic that says, weak point. For a guy's weak point. Like, you make it horribly obvious when it's not even necessary.
Well, no.
Because there are other cues.
Well, I will have
plenty of people probably thought that you had to tell them, but a smart person wouldn't need to be told that the bright flashing red thing is the weak point.
Right, but the thing is, and, you know, we didn't do that because, you know, we saw, like, oh, some people didn't get it. We did that on purpose because there are a lot of things in games where you really can't be obvious enough, no matter what you do. And so sometimes you need to have four or five devices to redundantly express the same thing so that the player doesn't have to think a lot about what it's supposed to do.
So what prompted your being vague with the turrets?
Well, we didn't have enough time. We ran out of time. And that's the other thing.
This is the limitation of
your art. Zero.
There's, you know, obviously, you know, this device that, you know, if I'd wanted it to be executed in the way that you know, I originally intended, we would need to support it with a lot more devices in order for the player to understand the mechanic.
Upon first interaction with this enemy, so to speak, this turret, you could put a splash graphic that says, shoot to turn turret. And that would be it.
We could.
It'd be one, you know, flashy graphic.
We totally could. You know, because of just idiosyncrasies of the development process, right? You know, like, pretty much all I had disposal of was to do things in gameplay and not so much, like, express them in, like, UI terms, right? Mm-hmm. So anything I had tried to communicate...
UI's user interface.
Right. Anything I had to communicate to the player, you know, here's the thing, right? You know, I could either, A, make a game mechanic and try to have the interaction speak for itself, and hopefully that's communicated by itself, right? Or it's like, well, if I wanted to, you know, let's say, do what you're suggesting, right? What I have to do is, you know... okay, now I have to go to somebody else to make this thing for me. So I have to go, hey, we need this other thing. I need to go to an artist and say, can you make this asset for me? You know, I need to go to a programmer and say, can I have programming support? Because this is a very specialized type of asset we don't have support for. Which, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, people don't work with each other. They do. But now you're introducing other things into the equation that are independent of me. And, you know, artist has better things to do. Programmer has better things to do. The coordination of it, you know, between three people doing the same thing takes much, much longer than one person who can do it themselves. And that's
like so the red tape in politics is a major hindrance to game development.
It is. And, you know, I don't want to call it like red tape in politics because it's not like something that's evil. It's just there's no like I don't want to say that there's any bad connotation to it because it's just the simple side effect of there being a lot of people coordinated in doing the same thing. And when you can work on stuff that, you know, you don't need to depend on other people to finish, you know, those kinds of things will get done much, much faster, like, you know, way, way faster.
All right. No, I can understand that.
So that's the explanation.
I sure wish I knew that, and I think I'll have an easier time throughout the rest of the game because I bet you put a ton of those damn lasers in.
No, they only appear in that stage.
Well, I mean, they were at the first level.
Yeah. No, the beginning of that stage. Right?
No, I mean, you're introduced to a turret, like, at the very beginning of the game.
Wow, are we even talking about the same thing now?
The red star.
Yeah, I know that.
No, I know what you're saying. It's a laser turret that has a laser shooting in four, you know, four directions. It's, you know, the...
Yes. Whatever. No, that particular object was only in that one level, dude. Unless some crazy guy came in and started putting them in other places.
I mean, it was a much bigger one at the beginning of the game, but...
Right, but it didn't behave the same way. I mean, it had a laser. There was a laser. Yes, it was a totally different object, though. I think that's where the confusion's coming
right.
from.
Well, I, as the game player, thought it was the same thing. Yeah. That might say something about the particular object.
Well, that's another issue, too, is that, you know, art is very, very important in distinguishing function to the player.
Yeah.
And, you know, one thing that's hard to do in general is, you know, when you have a concept, an idea of, you know, what is this, you know, turret supposed to do, sometimes it's hard to communicate that to another person for them to really understand, you know, what's the essence of this. And when you have like one artist making this turret and some artist is making something else, right? Once again, coordination and communication. You know, person A doesn't really necessarily know exactly everything about what person B is doing. So, you know, to the player, it's very important for like turret A and turret B to look completely different because they are, right? But because, you know, two other people are working on them, they're not talking to each other, it may come out that they're not sufficiently differentiated.
Maybe Alon just isn't as smart of a gamer as he thinks he is.
That, I think, is the true lesson of tonight's show.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think maybe I just don't have it. I say I have it, but I don't.
But I was glad that you know one of my fellow designers finally was like, yeah, you got to make those destructible, and you know I was glad that he said that, and you know I didn't want to do it, but I was glad I did it in the end because yeah, you know what, the interaction wasn't complete, it didn't have the effect it intended, and so we changed it. We went in a different direction, like I was talking about in the beginning of the show. You know,
was this like a major thing you stressed over for a week?
I'm sure I stressed over it, of course. You stress over everything in the design.
Okay.
I do anyway, but, I mean, that's just part of me being a designer.
See, on a personal note, and try to leave specifics out of this, but, like, Ara comes to me and says, you know, there's this thing that I'm dealing with in the game, and I can't really talk about it, but, like, this, the way he describes it to me is that it's something I would probably consider not vital, not a big deal. But, like, it's, like, poor sweat is dripping from his brow, and he's all concerned and about how this particular interaction might affect the game. Like, it's all very core to his being, even though it's something that I might consider minute.
I think details are exceptionally important. I think that everything good about games is in the details, and if you gloss over them, then you don't have something good. So, but that's just me.
Yeah. And then, you know what, I'll finally get to play Cars 2, and I'll see that he was just talking about putting a sewer in the middle of the road or not having the sewer cap in the middle of the road and how it changes the gameplay wildly. And I had no idea that that it did that. But anyway, we've got a few minutes left in this segment of the show. Make that 1 minute left in this segment of the show. Rich, we've brought you on as the senior investigative reporter of crap that people don't care about.
Yes.
And there's actually something that I might care about that you know, I heard about.
Maybe he needs to be promoted.
I want you, perhaps.
To crap that people care about.
I want you to relay some of these details.
All right,
what is going on?
I'll try to do it quick if we only have 30 seconds now.
All right, let's inject a little spunk into that.
Game Informer reported a sort of rumor, sort of this is going to happen. 90% of the people in the Nintendo of America sales and marketing staff are quitting or leaving the company because it's moving to...
This is Game
90%?
90%. I don't know how many employees
there are. So if 10 people work for Nintendo,
9 of them
now one person works for them.
For
in the
marketing department.
In marketing.
Marketing department.
Well, I've never been to the...
So this is Game Informer, not GamePro, right?
This is Game Informer.
How GameStop ever achieved this status, I don't understand. It's all related to Funko Land. But talk about that if you want in a minute. All right, so they claim that 90% of the marketing staff is leaving.
Yes.
Nintendo, I think, disagrees with that number, but we're going to talk a little bit more about that after the break.
Welcome back, guys. This is the final segment of Chatterbox Video Game Radio. I'm half of your host. My name's Ara.
And I'm Alon.
The other half. And we've got a third half, actually, so we're kind of like...
We are 150% Chatterbox Video Game Radio.
That's right. What's your name?
Do I count for a whole half?
It's Rich!
You, my friend, are an entire half.
Because I'm the news reporter that nobody cares about.
That's true.
I think we should report him.
I'm
think
like
we should
fourth?
Promote him.
Not only that, you are the senior investigative reporter of crap that people don't care about from the University of Advancing Technology.
I think we should.
Ooh.
I think we should promote him to the senior investigative reporter of rubber donkey spanking.
I'm happy to do that if he can prove himself tonight.
All right.
We were talking a little bit about Nintendo. You had told me before the show, and you're about to tell me during the show, that apparently a whole bunch of Nintendo marketing people are leaving. Now, I had read a little bit about this myself, but the reason we bring you in here is to fill in the gaps.
Yes.
And so is Nintendo trying to say that this 90% is not the right number? Aren't they saying it's something smaller, like 60?
Yeah. Reggie Fils-Aimé came out and said then that it's about 60%. But one of the important things that Game Informer mentioned was that among the people that are leaving are like Perrin Kaplan, who's the vice president of marketing at corporate affairs, and then George Harrison, which is like the senior vice president. I don't know what the difference is.
These are big names.
They're like two of the biggest names in marketing. Right next to Reggie Fils-Aimé, it's George Harrison and Perrin Kaplan for Nintendo of America.
One guy makes, you know, about $400,000 or $500,000 more than the other. That's sort of senior.
Yeah. Well, it's they both make a lot of money at Nintendo.
One guy has an extra island instead of having just one island.
Probably.
Okay, but what's their excuse for leaving?
According to this, they're leaving because basically Nintendo said, you're moving to San Francisco or New York. I don't know which one exactly.
Okay, so they're liquidating
Well, they're just moving campuses. They're not liquidating. They're just
saying... So what's going to happen to the school?
I don't know.
What, DigiPen?
Well, I don't think they're moving everybody. It's just like the
like corporate stuff?
Corporate and marketing stuff like that. I don't know.
Obviously, we're just talking about Nintendo of America here, not Nintendo of Japan.
No. They're not moving everything. They're moving the marketing and advertising departments to other cities.
Because there aren't enough earthquakes in Redmond.
Oh, of course not.
Okay, so they're moving everybody, and supposedly,
they're
pretty
offering,
much no one wants to go.
Yeah, they're offering, they're saying, hey, you can move to this city, or you can leave. And apparently, according to Game Informer, it's 90%. According to Reggie, it's 60%. But Reggie doesn't mention any specific names on who is leaving or who isn't. So he doesn't deny that George Harrison and Perrin Kaplan aren't leaving.
Okay.
But he doesn't confirm it.
All right, let me ask you this question. You got a Wii recently, right?
Oh, I sure did.
Are you enjoying that Wii?
I am. Well,
say yes.
not as much
say
as
yes.
I want to. But if I had more free time...
Right now, perhaps, isn't the best time for you to be playing.
Yes.
But you bought a Wii. Now, how did you buy this Wii?
F yes is the answer.
Okay. How did you acquire the Wii?
Through much searching throughout the land, I finally found someone who had gotten one who was willing to give it up. Because you can't find it in stores!
All right.
Because everybody's buying them.
Why can't you find them in stores, Rich?
It's because they're selling out everywhere, because everybody wants one, because it's marketed correctly.
Okay.
Is my, I mean...
Could you buy a PS3 if you wanted right now, Ara?
I could buy about 40 PS3s.
Okay, forget the fact that none of us could afford to buy 40. We could certainly find 40 of them.
$20,000.
Yeah. All right, but the Wii, I just had a coworker tell me that he can't find one anywhere, that his daughter called 15 stores, all in a 30-mile radius of his home, and couldn't find a single Wii.
See, I knew that was going to happen. That's why I was just refused to try too hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But now, go ahead.
I've always said that getting one on opening day, there's a reason you wait in line. It's because the only day you can be absolutely guaranteed there will be one. Now, big chains have been changing that a little bit by having multiple release days. That's happened lately, but that's really first for this generation. In the past, the only day you could guarantee it was day one and when they finally became available in stores.
And it's really retarded, too. But I digress.
Yeah. So, we know that the Wii is a big deal
extremely
in selling.
Extremely successful.
We know that the Nintendo DS or DS Lite is selling better than any other video game system, period, right
DS
now.
DS is insane.
So they have a completely impossible to buy system because it's too popular, not because it's, I don't know, not being produced or
they
something.
They sell a lot.
They have the number one most popular system, period, which is selling for, you know, just as much as the PlayStation 2 sells for right now.
Mm-hmm.
And they're selling oodles of software, for at least for the DS. I don't know about the Wii, because I still can't find a game that I really want to play on the Wii. Although
Excite
I have to spend more time into it. I am really enjoying Excitra.
That was a launch game, but
I told you, boy, it was good.
Yeah. So, Nintendo seems like they're fairly successful right now, and I would assume that their marketing is part of the reason for that. Yet everyone's leaving and choosing, supposedly, opting to continue with the company at the height of its success. Like, during the GameCube, it had the Game Boy Advance, but the GameCube wasn't doing much for it.
No.
The Nintendo 64 wasn't doing much for
the
Nintendo.
The Wii and DS combo is way bigger than the Game Boy Advance GameCube combo could ever become. Like, it just blows it out of the water how many DSs they're selling and how many Wiis they're selling already, not even a year into it.
All right. So we know they're selling like hotcakes, right?
They're selling like, I mean...
My point is, they're doing well.
They're extremely well.
Why would the vast majority of their marketing team, who apparently did a good job...
I ask you, why? Well, do you guys? I mean, this is obviously a very mysterious thing. Do you guys have any ideas? Because I sure don't.
It sounds like you're asking us as if we have a hidden answer that you know about, but I have no idea.
They're leaving because they don't want to move to a different city. Is supposedly what's going on. They're like, oh, I don't want to move to San Francisco.
Okay, so why is that such an unfeasible proposition?
Is it because in Redmond you get free prostitutes as part of a city?
I don't know. Like, maybe I've never been to Redmond. Maybe it's just like an incredible city.
It's a really nice
place.
But
I mean, look at it from the stance that, I mean, all these people and then even two of the highest people in the marketing department at Nintendo, which presumably make a considerable amount of money, are choosing to leave a company that's going to be at the height of their success in the next 5 years.
I've got a conspiracy theory. You know, there's a lot of big tech companies in Redmond, aren't there?
Microsoft.
Okay. Pretty much it.
There's
owns
a big tech company
entire city.
Microsoft. Right.
And Nintendo's like a chunk right outside. And
okay. You know what? If I'm, you know, whether I'm, you know, just like some average marketing guy or, you know, senior vice president of marketing owns Four Islands, you know, let's say my company is moving and they're like, okay, you know, you can go to New York or you can go to, you know, Earthquake City. And I don't really want to leave. But they, you know, maybe they'll give me an incentive, maybe they won't. But what if I don't want to leave? And then what if, you know, Microsoft comes up to me and is like, hey, you know what? We have a place for you, and we can pay you, you know, maybe a little more than what you're making, you know, and maybe buy you an extra island, and you don't have to leave. Maybe something like that's happening.
That might happen.
You think Microsoft?
We might see George Harrison working
over
at Microsoft.
I'm just doing sheer speculation. If it's true that we have no good reason why they would want to leave, that's the only thing I can think of.
I would not be surprised if, like, they ended up working for Microsoft.
I really don't think Microsoft would be going after them just because they happen to be in Redmond already.
I don't know, but...
But it is really weird because it seems to me like they're probably most successful now, proving their success, and now Nintendo's getting rid of them. Because I really don't believe they're leaving on their own.
It's got to be something else than moving to a city.
I don't know. What I can be sure of is that the show is over.
It is.
We are done with another approximately 40 minutes of the show.
Hopefully my moves wasn't completely worth it.
We'll be back next week, everybody, on Wednesday from now on. Wednesday starting next week.
Good night, guys.
You've been listening to Chatterbox Video Game Radio. Tune in next week for more tips and info and the latest and greatest in video gaming. And remember, all your base are belong to us.